get to where I am from the get-go. Find it like a dude. All right, my friends, welcome back to Anti-War Radio Chaos 95.9 in Austin, Texas. Our first guest today is Patrick Coburn. He's the Middle East correspondent for The Independent in England. He's the author of The Occupation, War, Resistance, and Daily Life in Iraq. And his next book is Muqtada al-Sadr, The Shia Revival and the Struggle for Iraq, due out in April. Welcome to the show, Patrick.
Nice to be with you.
Yeah, it's good to have you back on the show today. And, of course, the big news is the suicide bombing assassination of Benazir Bhutto in Pakistan. Supposedly, according to some headlines at least, Al-Qaeda is claiming responsibility. Your first impressions?
Well, it's kind of, shocking that it was quite so easy. I mean, they tried before and blew up a bus fairly successfully, and the second time around they do it, and so one sort of wonders how far the government of Pakistan was trying to keep her in one piece.
Mm. That's interesting. You know, when I talked with Eric Margolis a couple of months ago about this, he said that it was at least possible that in that attack, that failed attack that you refer to, that it was even Musharraf behind it.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think, you know, anybody would rule that out. Or if not Musharraf directly, Pakistani military intelligence has always had strong links to the Taliban in Afghanistan, to elements supporting Al-Qaeda, and have reasons to eliminate Benazir. So the fact that somebody was trying so hard and eventually tried successfully to kill her, I think that almost everybody has a strong suspicion that it wasn't just some lonely cell of Islamic fanatics that dreamed this up. It's also impressive that, you know, that the security was so slack. It's difficult to stop a suicide bomber. It's difficult to stop a suicide bomber if somebody is holding political demonstrations. But normally most people can do a bit better than the Pakistani government succeeded in doing.
Well, now, I guess the narrative is that Musharraf is a Western-friendly, more or less secular dictator who's on our side against the Islamic crazy suicide bomber types. Should we expect some kind of reaction from his government against them, or is this all just a wink nudge between his government?
I think we'll have a very vocal reaction. You know, they'll round up the usual suspects, but will anything change? I'd be very doubtful. You know, it's you were saying more or less secular. It's kind of less secular rather than more.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's been under the various military dictators of Iraq that extreme Islamic movements got their start, were encouraged, were linked to Pakistani military intelligence. So they've never done that well at the ballot box, but the real source of their power has been their connection to the army, and the army when it's in power in Islamabad.
And now, do you think that the Musharraf government basically has no motive, really, to go after the Arab Afghans who escaped from Afghanistan into Pakistan, who are still holed up in Waziristan?
Well, I think they have a motive to go after them, and I think they have a motive not to find them. I think that's true of Osama.
Ah.
I remember talking to, a U.S. official who was very experienced in Pakistan, and about why the Pakistani intelligence and army never seemed to find Osama. And he was saying, of course they don't find him, because they remember what happened in after the 1980s, that when there were Soviet troops in Afghanistan, the U.S. was nice to Pakistan, gave them a lot of money, gave them support. The moment the Soviets left, suddenly the money stopped coming, and they started being critical of the way that Pakistan was being governed, or misgoverned. And he's saying the same time around, they know so long as they pursue Osama, then they're going to get support and money from Washington. Any day that they actually find Osama, mission accomplished, then the money's going to stop coming.
Right.
I think it's a bit more complicated than that, but it's certainly something to consider.
Yeah, in terms of basic economic incentives, it seems like you've got it right there for sure. Now, in terms of the death of Bhutto now, what does this mean for the movement among Democrats who would like to have a democratically elected or, you know, a prime minister chosen by the parliament instead of a military dictator? Was she, you know, their big star, and now they're severely damaged by this, you think? Or
Benazir was very much backed by the U.S. and Britain as the person who was going to come in and wasn't going to overthrow Musharraf, but was going to either cohabit with him politically, or was, you know, there was going to be a change from Musharraf, from the military regime, but not a radical one.
Right, some sort of power sharing.
And but it seems from the beginning that there are elements within the Pakistani government, either including Musharraf, not including Musharraf, who didn't see it that way at all, that they saw her as a real threat. Although she'd been, you know, her reaction to the declaration of martial law was pretty pretty mute. She called for demonstrations, but she could have been much tougher. So, from the it seems to me clear from the beginning, a large part of her strategy was an alliance or a peaceful takeover with the military government. But I think it's obvious that there were those within the regime who weren't going to go along with this, and there must be a strong suspicion that they were connected to those who carried out the assassination.
Yeah, pretty strange allies to have in the so-called war on terrorism, although I guess the argument would be that it's better than the alternative, that if the U.S. doesn't prop up the Pakistani military and whichever government is in power there, that the nukes are going to end up in the hands of the kooks and get used.
Well, yeah, but maybe, I mean, you know, Pakistani military regimes tend to play both ends against the middle. One, they cultivate the U.S. Secondly, they cultivate the extreme Islamic groups. So the and they've done so pretty successfully. The U.S. is obviously, Washington is obviously frightened of anything that might come after Musharraf.
Yeah. Well, now, one thing that Eric Margolis did tell me was that he thought that the chances if a suicide bomber got Mubarak, Mubarak, Musharraf, same difference. If a suicide bomber did get Musharraf, that, you know, 90% chance or so, I guess, the strongest likelihood would be that another one just like him would take over, that it wouldn't, that the kooks really don't have that much power. As you say, they're useful for being, you know, played against the other side or something like that. But at the end of the day, another general would replace him if it came down to it.
Yeah, but it's, you know, it depends what the circumstances are. I mean, that might be true, but not all the power belongs to the government or belongs to the generals. You know, you have a large chunk of Pakistan in the northwest frontier, which are controlled by the tribes, are controlled by Taliban from Afghanistan. You have areas much closer to Islamabad where which have been taken over by Islamic groups recently. So on the ground, it's not, you know, it's not as though you had a single Pakistani government, and basically if it wasn't one general, it'd be the other. Things are changing on the ground. The ability of the government to actually control things is getting more and more limited.
Mm-hmm. Like William Lynn says, everywhere the states are losing against non-governmental forces.
Yeah, I think there's an element of, you know, there's a strong element of truth in that. And it doesn't go back to a point you made earlier. It doesn't necessarily mean that the non-government forces are that strong. It just means that governments tend to be often very weak.
Yeah.
You know, you look at them, they seem to have large armies, they seem to have big bureaucracies, they seem to have money, but then it turns out that nobody much likes them and nobody's prepared to get killed for them. So they go down just like that.
Right. Yeah, that's interesting. You know, an argument I've been involved in recently has involved well, America as Osama bin Laden's indispensable ally, basically our foreign policy making him seem right about all his accusations against us. And even though we've basically fallen into his trap and we're spending all of our treasury over, you know, in the sand pit just like he wanted us to do and so forth, it still has only worked halfway. It has not seemingly rallied the people of the Muslim world around him just against us.
Yeah, you see, I mean, I think your terrorism is always a trap. It's a trap in the sense that, you know, normally the number of terrorists is pretty limited. And what they're aiming for is not exactly to intimidate governments by blowing up people, but to the real, where they're really effective, is tempting a government into an overreaction.
Right.
You know, most governments, any part of the world, what do they want? They want more power, but more authority. And it's very attractive for governments to think, aha, here is a small group which frightens everybody, and we'll go to war with it, and then we can do what we want. You know, I think this was true of, you know, the government of the Tsars when they were in Russia in the 19th century, when terrorists blew up the Tsar. Then they could say, great, well, let's forget about reform, and we'll just go after this group, and everybody can unite against that.
Mm-hmm.
This is very tempting for governments. So it makes terrorists look more substantial, more influential than they are. It rules out reforms. It tends to discredit the governments that are pursuing them.
Yep. In fact, to tie this into Iraq now, in your most recent article for The Independent about Iraq, you talk about one of the mistakes that the Sunni insurgency made was their calculation that if they got into more of a heated war with the Shia Arabs, that Egypt and Saudi Arabia and other Muslim states would come to their aid and would help rally to their cause, and that didn't really work out too well for them either.
No, I mean, the point I was making is, you know, I think it's a mistake they made. It's a mistake the U.S. made in Iraq. Is, you know, the U.S. is the single most important factor in Iraq, but it isn't by any means the only factor. But it's very tempting for the U.S., for the U.S. media to think that it's America that makes all the weather, the political weather in Iraq. And that really isn't so. So I think that it can. What's been happening in Iraq over the last year is partly the result of actions by the U.S., but it's also the fact that the Sunni, who were the basis for the insurgency against U.S. forces, discovered that they weren't doing too badly against the U.S., but they were doing very badly against the Shia Iraqis, that's 60% of Iraqis, who had driven them out of most of Baghdad. And this is one of the reasons that you suddenly see the insurgency really switching sides.
Mm-hmm.
Suddenly you have people going on the U.S. payroll who used to be blowing up U.S. soldiers.
Yeah, you have an interesting quote from one of the leaders of the so-called Sunni Awakening there, where he talks about, well, like you're just saying, they were doing okay against the American occupation. Then Al-Qaeda picked a fight for them against the regular Shia Arab population of Iraq, which got them cleansed out of Baghdad. It was a fight they couldn't win. But then this insurgent leader told you in this article that we can only fight one enemy at a time. So we're calling off our fight against the American occupation. Sounds like what he was saying there was they're really getting ready for a further full-scale war against their fellow Shia.
Yeah.
Fellow Arabs,
I mean,
this is the war
which was going really badly for them. You know, I think Baghdad used to be probably about 65% Shia. Now I'd say it's about 75%. When I'm in Baghdad, I normally have a couple of Sunni Arab drivers. And 6 months ago, I found that I couldn't really use them. There was nowhere safe for them to drive. It was more dangerous for them than it was for me, because so much of Baghdad is controlled by the Shia. Sometimes they couldn't even go home at night. I'd put them up in my hotel. And this was really typical of what was happening to Sunni and the whole of Baghdad. A lot of them had fled to Jordan and to Syria. So, you know, there was less and less incentive for them to fight the U.S. because if the U.S. left, then they were still going to get it in the neck from the Shia. And so I think that's why there was a great incentive to really think, well, the moment has come to call off the war against the U.S. and, if possible, ally ourselves with them.
And so then you think their plan is to try to take back at least enough of Baghdad that they could try to take over the whole government at the time we leave?
I don't think that some of them may have that ambition. It'd be very difficult to do. I think a lot of them feel that, you know, they need to stabilize the situation within their own areas, get people to come back. Then some of them will want to, you know, all the areas that used to be mixed are no longer mixed. Most of them have been taken over by the Shia.
Mm-hmm.
There are a few people going back into mixed areas, but not many. So I think that, you know, they may, well, the one thing they don't, and this is kind of the rather amazing thing which has happened in Iraq this year, is you have these 70 or 80,000, Sunni ex-insurgents.
Mm-hmm.
And bear in mind, quite a number of these people are going to be ex-Al-Qaeda as well.
Yeah, these are friends now.
And so it's kind of bizarre that these ex-Al-Qaeda fighters now allied and paid for by the U.S.
Well, now, are they just, you know, sitting back and kind of rearming and preparing for further war against the Shia? Are they actually going to try to join the Iraqi army and create this multi-ethnic government that the Americans have supposedly been trying to create?
It's a very good point. The thing is that, one, the Iraqi government is basically Shia Kurdish. That's 80% of the population.
Mm-hmm.
They kind of don't want, they say they want these guys sort of under their control, but they know that these guys suspect them and hate them more than they do the U.S., and that their connection is to the U.S., not to the Iraqi government.
Mm-hmm.
It's really whatever General Petraeus says. I mean, he's denied that he's setting up a Sunni militia, but that's exactly what he's set up. It's a very large group of armed people, all Sunni, who don't answer to the Iraqi government and do answer to the U.S. forces insofar as they answer to anybody.
Well, and they keep saying that if you don't bring us into the Iraqi army, we're going back to war against you. I mean, it seems like the Maliki government's been trying to get them to submit to their authority this whole time, and finally they have the opportunity to bring them in, but they're afraid to take it.
Yeah, but it depends how they come in. You see, they're not going to come in one by one.
Uh-huh.
They're going to come in as totally Sunni units. I mean, they want to be part of the Iraqi army and armed as part of the Iraqi army, wear the uniform, get the money. But I don't think they have too many plans to obey what the Iraqi government tells them to do. So it's a real sort of change in the balance of power. Previously, the Iraqi army at the moment probably has 60-70% of its officers are Shia. I mean, somebody who used to be a senior Iraqi defense official was telling me the other day that when a Shia applied to be an officer or an officer applied for promotion, in the past, the Iraqi government would look for a Shia who was really conscious of being a Shia and didn't like the Sunni. And when a Sunni applied to be an officer or get promoted, they try and make sure that he wasn't too conscious of being a Sunni.
Mm-hmm.
So you have a very sectarian army. And so I think any idea that these forces will simply be incorporated into the army is really very airy-fairy.
Mm-hmm.
It's what they want is to be Sunni units controlling Sunni areas. And the most that would ever happen that they would get along with the government. They wouldn't really be at the command of the government.
So is this I don't know. It's funny. People debate back and forth whether there's any rhyme or reason behind this policy at all. Some people assume that, well, it must be a deliberate policy to divide Iraq into pieces. There are others who say, no, this is just outright incompetence. I have to say, it does kind of remind me of the three-state solution as proposed by Richard Haass at the Council on Foreign Relations and Joe Biden and them, that, you know, do what you can to empower different groups in different ways in different areas to keep Iraq divided so presumably we can stay there forever.
It could work like that, but I mean, there are forces in both directions. You know, the idea that you could divide Iraq up neatly doesn't hold water. For one thing, Iraq is very much dominated by the capital, Baghdad. That's about a quarter of the population. what happens in Baghdad is pretty decisive and who holds Baghdad. Also, Iraq has one thing going for it, which is oil revenue. And the oil fields are mostly in the far south. They aren't just in the Shia south. They're mostly around, some are up in Kirkuk, but the really big ones are all around Basra, the three provinces around Basra in the very far south.
Mm-hmm.
So it's very difficult to divide up the country. And you have the, you know, Iraq Kurds, Sunni and Shia, very suspicious of each other at the moment, hate each other, but there's also a certain Iraqi nationalism as well. Most certainly the Kurds are different, but the among the 80% who are Arab, the Sunni and Shia all say that they want to be in a united country. They've got very different ideas of what that united country would be like.
Mm-hmm.
But there's no question that they do want to be in a united country. So the idea that you can carry out simple surgery and you have a sort of three-part Iraq, which everybody gets on, I think is very naive.
Well, I mean, to a degree, it does come down to the security forces, right? I mean, if the Sunnis have their militias and they're independent from the government, then in effect, you do have a separate state there, no?
You're halfway towards a separate state, but you don't quite have a separate state.
Yeah.
Because they don't want to, you know, at the end of the day, who's going to pay them? Who's going to control the oil revenues? You know, there is a reason for controlling the government.
Right.
And the government still, although it's sort of within the green zone, it still controls the revenues. So I don't think that we're going to just, it's called a three-state solution. You could have a three-state situation, but it wouldn't be a solution.
Right. Now, am I being ignorant and focusing so much on the people in Iraq and what they want and kind of ignoring the international politics here in terms of whether the Iranians in alliance with their new allies in southern Iraq become the dominant force in OPEC or whether it remains the Saudis and the role of Egypt and Saudi Arabia and Jordan and that kind of thing? How much do these international politics have to do with the situation on the ground there?
Oh, I think they have a lot to do with it. You know, above all, Iran. I mean, Iran has been involved in what happens in Iraq for the last 5,000 years, and that isn't really going to change. Of course, they were delighted when the U.S. overthrew Saddam because he was their enemy who'd invaded them in 1980. And I think that probably the two essential priorities for the Iranians, it doesn't matter who's in control in Iran, this would be truth, the Shah was still running Iran, is one, that they intend that in future in Iraq, the Iraqi Shia, who are 60% of the population, as I said, are sort of going to be running the show or predominant in the government. They're not going to recede from supporting that. Secondly, they're never going to let Iraq become a platform for an attack on Iran. Once they can get most of what they want there, then I think they'll compromise. But on those issues, and they're important issues, I don't think you'll see any compromise.
Mm-hmm. And now, what about the Saudis' position on all this?
Well, they go backwards and forwards. They were very frightened a year ago, what seemed to them that the Shia were taking over. King Abdullah in Jordan talked about a sort of Shia crescent with Hezbollah at one tip in Lebanon and the Iraqi Shia militias of Muqtada al-Sadr and others and Iran. They seem rather less frightened now and seem to be cultivating better relations with the Iranians. But overall, the Sunni regimes, Saudi Arabia, Egypt, Jordan, are all pretty nervous of the situation and what is what has happened since the fall of Saddam.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm very interested to see that your next book is about Muqtada al-Sadr, and I guess that brings us to the major division. And I know there are lesser ones, the Fadila Party and that kind of thing, but the major division between the Shia Arabs in Iraq is between the Sadr faction and the Hakim faction. Is that right?
That's right. I mean, these are two traditional clerical families, clerical political families. Both of them fought Saddam. Both suffered sort of horrific losses and assassinations and executions. Muqtada al-Sadr, the leader of the Sadrists. His father and two brothers were assassinated by Saddam's gunmen in 1999. His father and his wife's father, his father-in-law, was executed in 1980. The al-Hakim family, I think 73 of the relatives of the Abdulaziz al-Hakim, the present leader, were executed by Saddam. So these are important families, but there's also a social division that Muqtada tends to represent, the poorer Shia, who are the majority of them, and the rather better off, the merchants, the businessmen, the shopkeepers, are represented by the al-Hakim family and their political faction.
And now, is it right that the Hakim faction would be said to be far more in alliance with the Iranians than Sadr, who claims to be a nationalist and always insists on American withdrawal?
Well, it's so peculiar, you know, that the main U.S. ally in Iraq, despite everything that the White House has said about the Iranians, was actually the al-Hakim family, and what used to be called SCIRI, the Supreme Council for Islamic Revolution in Iraq, was set up by the Iranians in 1982, and may still be controlled by them. Certainly it's heavily influenced by them, but it's always gone along with the continuation of the occupation. It seems to me that the Iranians want to have money on both horses. They want to win whatever happens, because the other horses, as you say, Muqtada al-Sadr, who has denounced the occupation, fought the U.S. Marines twice at Najaf in 2004, the U.S. is more and more allied to Skiri. But traditionally, his family have been anti-Iranian. Of course, they come under pressure from the U.S. They look for support from Iran. So I think what the Iranians, and this is very typical of the way the Iranians often behave, is they put money on every faction. And so whatever happens, they're going to come out a winner. I mean, there was a friend of mine a couple of years ago who was an Iraqi Shia leader who was himself very anti-Iranian, and he went on a trip around southern Iraq, and when he came back, he said to me, he said it's very difficult to be anti-Iranian in southern Iraq because the Iranians pay all the pro-Iranian parties, and they pay all the anti-Iranian parties as well. So they basically, you know, their tactic is to have everybody in their pocket.
Well, now, at the end of the day, does Sadr or Hakim, do they really represent the Shia Arab population at all? I mean, I know Sadr has a pretty big power base, but what is it in proportion to the Shia population of the country?
Well, it's probably pretty big. If there was an election now, he'd probably come out on top. The other faction, they got money, they're well-disciplined. The al-Hakim faction, Skiri, they got money, they're well-disciplined. They've got their own militia, which sort of controls the interior ministry. They control a lot of the local administration. They've got their hands a lot of money. But they're not very popular. So they probably don't want an election until the moment comes when they think they can fix an election.
Mm-hmm. I mean, there are some who say that the Dawa Party / Supreme Islamic Council government, that they really don't control anything but the Green Zone, and that if it wasn't for the American occupation, that the Iraqi Shia would send them all packing back to Iran, and perhaps not nicely.
It might happen that way, you know, but if you've got enough money and you sort of, you know, for instance, when they come under attack in places that are pretty unpopular, like Sadr City, what they simply do is hire tribesmen, I mean heavily armed tribesmen, to come and defend their interests. So, but they're also very rather dependent on the U.S. So,
see,
it's probably true that, you know, if the U.S. departed, then this government couldn't stand. It's been true, you know, for 3 or 4 years. I've always found it, you know, in some ways funny, but bizarre that, you know, when I talk to some official of the government, I mean, often pretty smart people they'd say, oh, we're doing pretty well, you know, the insurgency is collapsing, we're doing great. And you'd say, well, what happens if the Americans left tomorrow? Oh, God, we'd be out of business in 24 hours, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So in a way, you know, yeah, things are looking up for them, but they can only do anything because the U.S. is supporting them. Their own base of support is really pretty narrow.
And so what's the purpose behind that? Why is it that Sadr, as you say, has been in battles, full-scale battles with the Americans, although it's been a few years, continually denounces the American presence there? Why is it that we're backing the Iranian factions instead of the Iraqi factions? Is it only because the Iranians need us and the Sadrists
well,
don't?
Well, you see, I mean, I think, you know, why is it? I mean, it's because that U.S. policy has always been pretty bizarre in Iraq. You know, you go right back to 1991, the first Gulf War, that it was one of the reasons that, and this was written down in memos at the time, that the U.S. did not want to push on after kicking Saddam out of Kuwait, did not want to go on to Baghdad and kick him out of power entirely, was because it believed that the main beneficiary would be Iran. Now, it was as soon as the U.S. decided to overthrow Saddam, there were going to be two winners. The Iraqi Shia community, because as soon as you got rid of Saddam, who was a Sunni and his government was essentially Sunni, and you had elections, they were bound to win those elections. And this is a revolutionary change in Iraq, because for hundreds of years, it was the Sunni Arabs who had dominated the government and dominated the country. And at the same time, that was going to be, Iran was going to become more powerful in Iraq because their co-religionists would have taken power and their old enemy Saddam would be gone. And basically, you know, really ever since 2003, Washington has never really found a way of getting around this problem. Has always been seeking a way around this problem. But it hasn't done so. I think at the end of the day, this is what's going to happen. You are going to have a government which is dominated by the Shia, supported by the Kurds, and with strong Iranian influence. I don't think there's any other way out. But one of the reasons we have such instability is, I think, that the White House never really saw that and has never really accepted that.
And continues to occupy the place and shift the power around and shift the guns and the money around to this group and that group, and so nobody's really ready to make a peace deal because they don't know how things are going to come out in the wash, whose side America's
sure,
going to take on the way out.
No, you're exactly right. Nothing is resolved. You know, I don't want to... Some good things have happened. You know, one of things, you know, Al-Qaeda were a deeply bigoted organization. One of the things which really generated the mass slaughter in Iraq was these massive suicide vehicle bombs that they'd let off in Sunni Shia marketplaces and Shia religious processions, and hundreds of people would be killed and injured. And then the Shia would immediately, as word spread of this through Baghdad, would start hauling Sunni out of their cars and killing them in you know, a sort of tit-for-tat slaughter. Now, we aren't at the moment having these massive bombs generating this mass slaughter, but we have all the sort of friction between Sunni and Shia is still there. It's nothing much has been resolved. And the U.S., at the moment, allied with the Sunni militia, supported by the Kurds, the position is a bit stronger than, significantly stronger than it was a year ago. But, you know, has the U.S. won a victory? No, you know, I mean, this is to completely oversimplify what has happened.
Yeah, and does the surge really have anything to do with this at all? I know that the local Sunni Arabs were turning on al-Qaeda guys back at toward the beginning of 2006, even.
Oh, sure. I think that started early. It wouldn't surprise me even, you remember Abu Musab al-Zarqawi, the leader of al-Qaeda in Iraq. Now, al-Qaeda in Iraq doesn't have much to do with Osama. It was kind of a local franchise that grew up from grassroots. And then kind of announced that it was al-Qaeda.
Mm-hmm.
But it wouldn't surprise me if Zarqawi, who was killed in the spring of 2006, and information was clearly passed as to where he was, that may have been the beginning of a split within al-Qaeda.
Mm-hmm. A year before the troop buildup even began.
Oh, yeah. You then had al-Qaeda tried to overplay its hand. It tried to set up what it called the Islamic State of Iraq, which was to sort of treat the Sunni areas as if they were, that al-Qaeda was the only dominant force, and as if it was a sort of parallel government. Now, of course, this frightened all the non-al-Qaeda anti-U.S. insurgents, who were thought they were, rightly, they were going to get their throats cut. But also, there was great sort of popular terror in Sunni areas. I remember people I know there, their sons, suddenly there'd be a knock on their door, and the local, some sort of guys who said they were from Al-Qaeda, in Sunni areas of Baghdad, would say, yeah, we want one of your sons. We're taking one son from every family to join our forces. Secondly, they were going around killing people who they said worked for the government. But it was people who, you know, sometimes collected the garbage or had some tiny job which they'd taken to feed their families. They were being murdered. Now, there aren't many jobs in Iraq apart from the government. So this made everybody terrified. So there's no doubt that Al-Qaeda was deeply unpopular. But I think above all, there was a sense that Al-Qaeda had provoked this war with the Shia, and the Shia were winning. So the Sunni weren't just losing. They were on halfway down the road, which was to being kicked out of Iraq and becoming permanent refugees. Yeah. That their status might not just be loss of power, but they could end up like the Palestinians of living in refugee camps in other countries.
Yeah. Now, the last powder keg in Iraq that we haven't discussed really is Kirkuk, or the Kurdistan area, including Kirkuk, where the northern oil fields are. And we have problems there because there are Kurdish separatists. Now, I guess the main factions, the main power factions, the Barzani and Talabani factions, aren't pushing too hard for outright independence. But there's a group of terrorists called the PKK who've picked a fight with the Turks, or at least are responding to a fight the Turks picked or something. And now we have American approval for Turkish bombing raids inside Kurdistan. Which of our allies there do you think is more likely to get the outright stab in the back at the end of the day there?
Well, everybody's kind of wondering that there. I mean, I was in the mountains a few weeks ago with the, I went to see the PKK. They're not difficult to find by that stage anyway. In fact, they're about the only guerrilla organization I've ever come across that you could see from space, because they had an enormous portrait of their leader, Öcalan, who's imprisoned by the Turks. And they'd made a picture of his face out of painted stones on the side of the mountain.
Oh.
So not difficult to find.
And you were there just a few weeks ago, you say?
This was about 6 weeks ago, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, I could find them if they wanted to be found, but their actual real camps are high up in the mountains, you know, in valleys. They move the whole time. They're very difficult, pretty well impossible to find if they don't want to be found. And there aren't, this is a vast area of mountains, very few roads. You know, if you want to drive anywhere, you can use a tractor or a four-wheel drive, and you drive along the beds of rivers. And so it's not an area that anybody can, that it's easy to find anybody. And although the Turks claim that their air raids are having killed 150 guerrillas, I don't believe it for a moment. If they've killed people, it's almost certainly local civilians. But I doubt if there are even many of them, because most of this area is deserted. The villages were all destroyed by Saddam 20 years ago.
So do you see this escalating? Or I mean, it does seem like if you're trying to wage a war in the Rocky Mountains, you might as well just not bother.
Well, you could, but I mean, I in the 90s, this is the 24th time the Turks have sort of invaded, I mean, actually, northern Iraq, and they didn't get anywhere previous times. So I went with them once in, I think it was 1996, and I talked to the general, the Turkish commander, a lot of troops, he had about 40,000 men with him. And I said, are you finding any PKK? And he just said, laughed, and said, look, in these mountains, caves, he said, you know, it just can't be done. He said, you know, in staff college, we're taught you need X number of soldiers per square kilometer in a terrain like this to find anybody, and there's no way we could have that number. So I think there are many dangerous things about what's happening. At the moment, the Turks, within Turkey, there's a lot of jingoism. Get after the PKK. You look at newspapers and you think a really major war was going on. The Turkish government doesn't want to really intervene because that would strengthen the army. It doesn't want to do that. But it doesn't want also to be anybody to claim that it's not unpatriotic enough. So it's carrying out these raids high up in the mountains. But after a time, it'll become evident that these raids aren't really achieving anything. So what are the Turks going to do? Are they going to send in ground troops? Are they going to attack populated areas? This would create a reaction on the ground among the Iraqi Kurds. But overall, you know, it's a tremendous can of worms, and it's a very bizarre situation where you have the U.S. somehow okaying the attack, an attack on its ally and on the country it's occupying by another power, and apparently giving them information on who to attack. So, you know, it underlines once again what a dangerous and unstable place Iraq is.
Well, you know, one guest pointed out that the Turks don't have oil and the Kurds do. So at the end of the day, if there's going to be, you know, some full-scale war in Kurdistan in the years ahead, it's probably more likely that America's going to be fighting on the side of Barzani and Talabani.
Well, I think that's probably too far down the road. You know, certainly the Turks have thought about it, that there's oil in Mosul. Not very much, and there's even more in Kirkuk. I don't think that they'll try and capture it.
I think the implication was that America will take the Kurd side if the Kurds pick a fight over the border or anything else, that we'll want to secure that oil, not so much that the Turks are threatening.
I think the U.S. will try not to take either side at the moment, which is kind of rather desperately doing, because it needs the Kurds badly in Baghdad, because they're the most stable element in the government there. At the same time, Turkey is the second largest army in NATO, so they don't want to offend the Turks too much. Both sides are very suspicious of the U.S., thinking we're going to be stabbed in the back. But I think that Washington just hasn't decided, or is trying not to decide, who at the end of the day it would back. It just doesn't want that situation.
Mm-hmm. And now, well, how determined do you think PUK, the Barzani and Talabani factions, how intent are they on eventual independence? Or do you think they're happy with just Iraqi autonomy?
I don't think they'll go for it at the moment, because it's not in their interests. I mean, if they're independent, then they'd be much more vulnerable to the Turks. If they're part of the Iraqi government, that makes life much more difficult for the Turks, because they don't really want to go to war with Iraq. Also, it makes it much easier for them to be useful allies of the U.S. Again, they think if they were a small, isolated, sort of rock-bound little republic high up in the mountains, that nobody in the U.S. or certainly in the U.S. government would give much of a damn what they did. So I think it's, and after all, you know, the Iraqi president is a Kurd, Jalal Talabani, Hossein Zebari is the foreign minister. You know, they're a real power in Baghdad. I don't think they want to give that up.
Mm-hmm. How secessionist do you know are the Kurdish populations of Iran, Syria, and Turkey at this point?
They're all fairly secession. I mean, they're all pretty angry. On the other hand, in Turkey, there was this long insurgency between 84 and 99, led by the PKK, and this was crushed with enormous suffering. I don't think that will happen again, but the Turkish Kurds are certainly dissident, although at this stage, if the Turkish government could have a economic revival of the Kurdish areas, basically the whole of southeastern Turkey, then they'd probably they'd go along with it. In Syria, there are about 10% of the population, so they're not going to secede, but they also feel that their civil and human rights are being curtailed. In Iran, the same thing. The number of places where they think that they could actually gain independence at the moment, nationalist though they are, is quite limited.
Mm-hmm. And is it okay if I keep you just a couple more minutes?
Sure,
I have one more question. Do you recommend American withdrawal from Iraq as soon as possible? And if that were to happen, what do you see as the likely consequences or the likely shape of what takes America's place there?
Yeah, I'm wholly in favor of it and always have. But so long as you have the U.S. as an occupying power, things might die down for a bit. But it's never, the Iraqis are basically never going to accept it. Sometimes there can be an alliance with the Kurds, that might work for a bit, or there could be an alliance with the presence with the Sunni, but they're frightened of the Shia. You know, and you can play various games between the different ethnic and sectarian communities there, but it's going to be unstable, and all this is bad news for Iraq. And it's also bad news for the U.S. because you will have a continual grinding war going there. And there'll be moments of optimism in Washington, like at the moment, and there'll be moments of deep pessimism. But I think these colonial wars always have a bad effect on the imperial power, whether it's America or Britain or anybody else. So, yeah, I think the U.S. should end the occupation, should negotiate the end of the occupation, and then we could finally have a sort of stable peace. I mean, the U.S., whatever happens, is not going to stay there forever. The situation might gel at the moment. You have a government in power, which is kind of a protectorate of the U.S., but isn't going to last when the U.S. departs. Or you might have some sort of Latin American solution that you sort of have a government, you have a parliament, but you have an army which is sort of close to the U.S. army and doesn't quite sort of kind of obeys, it doesn't quite obey the government in power in Baghdad. So you have a series of other solutions which aren't really solutions to my mind.
Mm-hmm. Now, you know, the war party says, well, we just can't leave until everything is hunky-dory because everything will get so much worse. It might be bad now, but there will be a genocide if we leave. We just can't leave. What do you say to that?
Well, you know, they've said this. People like that have said that all along. You know, they were saying it, you know, when 10 people were being killed every week, you know, and then somehow we ended up by being 3,000 being killed every month. You know. And they said, well, things would, you know, we need things to get worse. But, no, I don't think that. I think that, you know, there are pluses and minuses in whatever the U.S. Does. But I think that there has to be a sort of determination that the objective is to get out and to get out fairly soon. And bear in mind also, you know, any opinion poll which is carried out in Iraq, this is what Iraqis want. But you know, by around 70%. This is very important. Iraqis don't want the U.S. to be there. I mean, opinion polls in the U.S. seem to show somewhat similar things. So if the great majority of the Iraqi American people think that the U.S. should withdraw, then I think the U.S. should withdraw.
Well, you know, there are some who say that the American military will have had it by around a year from now, that there's just not enough officers, there's not enough men in the Army, the equipment is run down, the budget is strained, and that they won't be able to do it. Do you foresee an end of this war anytime soon?
Not really, because, you know, they're not fighting a war like the Second World War. You know, armies always complain that they're down to their last round of ammunition and their last $10 bill. You know, it's usually so they can get even larger sums of money, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think it'll quite happen that way, but obviously they're under pretty serious strain. And I think that whatever happens, you know, you can have tactical victories on the ground, but you don't have a solution. You don't have an overall victory. Things look better for a bit, and then they'll look worse for a bit.
Well, and at this rate, it seems like they're just going to be able to keep getting away with putting us off in six-month increments. Just wait another little while, and I guess they can keep going like this for 50 years.
They can go on for a bit. I think that, but I think that, you know, it's, I don't think it can go on for 50 years. I mean, I'm amazed it's gone on so long. I was amazed during the last U.S. presidential election. I was in Iraq pretty well all the time then, and you know, you'd see Bush and Tony Blair getting up and saying, you know, there's a fighting only in three or four provinces of Iraq, and most of it is at peace. Of course, they never went to these places to prove that. And somehow they got away with it. Now, maybe they can get away with it a bit longer. But overall, you know, occupations always provoke resistance. In Iraq, they provoke a lot of resistance. At the end of the day, this isn't going to stop.
Yeah, well, South Korea, it's certainly not. I really appreciate your insight today. Everybody, Patrick Coburn, he's the Middle Eastern correspondent for The Independent. His recent book is The Occupation, War, Resistance, and Daily Life in Iraq. And his next one coming out in April is Muqtada al-Sadr, The Shia Revival, and The Struggle for Iraq. Thanks very much for your time today, sir.
Thank you.